All right. I made like, I don't know. Who gave lots of speeches? I guess Franklin Delano Roosevelt did the fireside chats. JFK was always good for a big-time speech. All the presidents give one, a State of the Union. I'm not the president. I'm more of an unelected king when it comes to the local sports talk scene. I was just appointed by somebody, and I've stayed in power, some monarchy of sorts. But I'm doing on the slowest local sports day of the year, and make no mistake, that's exactly what this is. I'm doing a state of the teams here. All three pro teams get the state of the blank treatment. State of the Pirates we already did. We'll have state of the Steelers later in the show. We'll also have Ray Fittipaldo of the Post-Gazette Steelers beat writer to respond to my state of the Steelers comments. And we now have state of the Pittsburgh Penguins. And I'm glad to do this one because they might be the most interesting. The Steelers are probably the most interesting because of who they've brought in. But the Penguins is the most unusual, perhaps, given what we have become conditioned to expect from them. As with the Pirates, if you're noticing a format, that's because I have made this a bit of a format thing. State of the Penguins, the thesis statement is this. How long will the bad times last? The good times they rolled. Who sang Let the Good Times Roll, Don?
Oh, I'm going to screw this up.
Well, I don't know either, so I'm not even going to yell at you if you get it wrong. I might just be using you as a distraction.
The Cars sang it. Okay, yeah, now that I'm hearing it, it's definitely them.
The Good Times Rolled for a long time.
I would have missed it. Thank you, Mulder.
Yeah, that's all right. It wasn't Beethoven's Fifth. I don't expect you to get things that aren't classically based anymore. I'm going to come to you and say the 1812 Overture, Don. Who wrote that one? I actually don't know that either. Anyway, the good times rolled, so the question becomes, how long will the bad times last? Make no mistake about it. I don't care what anyone else wants to tell you. I don't care if anyone wants to make some weird argument that two is greater than three or that never having a losing season is exceptionally impressive. This is the gold standard franchise in town for this century. No question. Three titles. They went back-to-back in the salary cap era. They were the first team to do it. They have since been equaled by the Lightning, been equaled by the Panthers. And the Panthers kind of look poised to exceed what the Penguins have done. But because they play in Sunrise bleeping Florida, there is way less juice associated with their dominance over the NHL of late. You always remember the first team to accomplish something. Steelers are always going to be the first team to have won four Super Bowls. Terry Bradshaw is always going to be the first quarterback to have won four Super Bowls. Chuck Knoll's always going to be the first head coach to have won four. That number, I think, matters in sports. I feel like four ends up being, or any kind of, four is a big number in football for titles. It's like a true Hall of the Immortals, even more than three is. I think there's a big jump and a gap there. But when you're the first to go back-to-back, that matters. We have, I think, gotten accustomed to the Penguins always being in it, way more so than the Steelers. Like, I've used this, I tried to use this in a feeble effort to win Judge Donnie yesterday. I tried to use this argument for Mike Tomlin. Wow, he's only coached one or maybe two games that I can remember where technically the Steelers did not have playoff stakes on the line because they were already eliminated. And I use that as this idea or this argument that, look how impressive that is. They're always, quote-unquote, in the mix. Wonderful. The Penguins really always were in it from essentially Sidney Crosby's second year in the league until what? This past year, really. They've always been in the mix. They haven't made the playoffs now 3 years straight, but the first two of those years, they had real chances to do it and blew it near the end of the season. But the games felt like they mattered. This was the first time you'd watch them and say, yeah, they got no shot. They were a lock for the playoffs before every season started. Most of the time, I think you shouldn't have taken that for granted, but people did. They were always a serious competitor, and their two eras were equally satisfying. Young core beats the Red Wings, an all-time great team in 09, to win their first cup. The middle-aged core goes back-to-back. The Mike Sullivan era yields all this fruit. A true blue blood of the league. Maybe like for maybe for the majority of Crosby's run, they were the blue blood. They were such a blue blood that DK, Dejan Kovacevic, once said that Pittsburgh was the new hockey mecca, very infamously. He was feeling frisky about him. Most people were. All good things, though, come to an end, and they did with the Penguins. And now we are bottoming out. They have quietly sunk. They haven't, like, crashed to rock bottom the way the Blackhawks did. They haven't totally cratered. But it's been a quiet but steady descent. Their ownership was the gold standard. Now it's faceless. The ownership was there was a connective tissue from the fans up to the owner's box, or from the glory days, the first set of glory days the franchise had, to the current one. Like, you had something so unique in Lemieux, the greatest player, becoming the savior from the owner's box that other teams didn't have. Everyone, you know, oh, the Roonies are great. Well, the Chief wasn't playing left tackle in the 1940s. Now you have faceless Boston-based company, and you have previous owners trying to get back in. And I think the reason that how long will the bad times last is the thesis statement is you have a very hotshot GM, you have a very empowered GM, you have a person in the form of Kyle Dubas who has been given almost unlimited say-so in how this team makes decisions, at the center of it all, trying to figure out how to get this team back to where everyone wants them to be. And I think the only definitive thing you can say, two things you can say about Kyle Dubas' tenure, is that the initial portions of it were pretty disappointing because I think he was trying to build a team that was still going to compete, and he failed at that task, and that he has now at least acquired a lot of assets, a lot of capital, a lot of flexibility for how he wants to try to build the Penguins moving forward. He has positioned them to stink this year, but he has positioned them to stink with at least a lot of picks coming up. Thing about all those picks, though, thing about the way he's positioned them is, in hockey, it's hard to say it all matters a ton because we have seen, and Pittsburgh has been the case study in this, that having a big-time superstar player is almost always going to serve you better. A generational-type talent is almost always going to serve you better than having like an assemblage of good players. The Panthers have won it without having McDavid. I get that. They've beaten them twice in a row without having the best in the game. They're an impossibly deep roster. Edmonton's been a comedy of errors in some ways for part of McDavid's era. But this has been a team, the Penguins, defined by having the best player in the league. I'm wondering, when I look at Kyle Dubas, this is how I always think about this, and this connects back to how long will the bad times last. I'm wondering what happens if he builds a team that is either very fun or very good, but not both. Namely the latter, like very good, but not aesthetically that fun to watch. Carolina Hurricanes, very good, not fun to watch. Panthers, I think, very good and very fun to watch. That's like kind of the best of both worlds. Think about what fans have become accustomed to in Pittsburgh. Not only is the team really good, they are almost always the most or one of the two or three most entertaining teams in the entire sport. I have said Harlem Globetrotters of hockey often because that always feels accurate. I have concerns about Kyle Dubas' ability to build something that both entertains and delights a fan base that has become accustomed to that style of play and is also really good. Never had a good, boring team. Always fun and always great. Kevin Constantine tried to make him a good, boring team. Jaromir Jagr said, hell no, I'm not playing for this guy. What happens if Kyle Dubas doesn't get Gavin McKenna next year? What happens if the lottery ball, if the golden goose, doesn't lay an egg for the third time in that regard? Then what? How long do the bad times last? And how long does a fan base that did go away post-Jagr trade, only to have like the ultimate jolt of adrenaline shot into it with Crosby, how long does that fan base have patience? I think I saw Josh Yowie write that they sold 91% of their tickets last year. That's like the lowest they've had in forever. The lowest going back to the ugly days, the Rico Fada administration. Kyle Dubas, jury out. I don't know how much appetite Pittsburgh has to watch a mediocre hockey team muddle through a rebuilding process. I really don't. I'm not even saying that that is necessarily a huge knock on Penguins fans. I just think it kind of is what it is. It's the fourth most popular of the major sports. It is sometimes, and I think even hockey fans would tell you this, it's sometimes hard to watch like game 48 in a season you know is going nowhere with players that you know aren't going really anywhere. The presence of Crosby still is going to make this a lot easier to handle. At the top of his game, still an attraction, still easily the most well-liked athlete going in this city by a mile. But just because you have that in your corner doesn't mean you have unlimited rope. I have questions about Kyle Dubas, and my big question about the Penguins is an unanswered one when I think of the state of this franchise. How long will these bad times, and make no mistake, everyone says it's a gift to recognize the good times while you're in them. It's also a gift to not have to spend much time in the bad times. How long are they going to last for the Penguins? Open Championship happening right now, and in 15 minutes, I am going to be inspired in the PM Team Power Rankings, and I'm going to rank the five best golf major venues, five best courses for major championships in golf. There are already whispers, rumblings, dare I say, that my recent trip to Pinehurst and my chance to play Pinehurst number 2 is going to significantly impact and influence these rankings. We'll see. We'll see. I can tell you one course that's not going to make it. Valhalla in Louisville. Maybe the crummiest major venue I can think of. Very nice golf course, I'm told. Not a place that should be hosting the PGA Championship ever again. No bueno. Anywho, state of the Penguins here. The thesis question on the Penguins is very simple, and it's how long are the bad times going to last? We got a lot of good times. Everybody was fat and happy. It was a nonstop party, and the music finally got turned off, and the lights got turned on. And now the question is, how long are you regrouping before the party starts again, if the party starts again? I think something that does have to get mentioned here, and I don't do this like with a sense of anything but kind of dread, because it is not fun to have to follow and cover a hockey team that's just slogging through a second-to-last or third-to-last finish. There's no guarantee that a rebuild works. The Blackhawks have been trying to do it for a while. They've had Connor Bedard for a couple of years now. It hasn't taken yet. The Kings did a good job, but then just had the worst offseason probably of any team in the NHL. The LA Kings looked like they were back on the rise, like they were kind of the model for the Penguins to follow. They had an atrocious offseason. Like, literally, when they have the GM on to basically ask him what the hell were you were thinking, not good. Like, you're not guaranteed that any of this works out the way you want it to, and I think it's easy to lose sight of that or lose track of that in Pittsburgh, because every time they've basically said, all right, we got to empty out the old shells here and reload this thing, they've done so successfully. If you never in your lifetime saw a team really fail for more than like a two-year stretch and be just dregs of the league, you too would probably start to think that they were incapable of doing that, of failing. You too would start to just treat success as a given. It'll be a couple of years and then they'll be back. I think people probably looked at the Steelers that way in the Cowher and early Tomlin eras, and look how long it's been since you've won a playoff game there, since you've been to a Super Bowl. Feels like one of the furthest things from your top-of-mind experience. I just wonder about the Penguins. I think that's going to be, it's going to be hard to ask them to get Gavin McKenna and to have this thing go their way in a lottery three times. I think we all laughed about it happening with Alexis Lafreniere. He's obviously not that kind of dude. It looks like McKenna is. We'll also have a chance to follow him pretty up close because he's going to be at Penn State. I think it is a fair question to ask of Kyle Dubas, given the fact that in Toronto, even in that cauldron of pressure, you give him a little bit of a pass for that. He built good teams. He never built great teams. He built teams that had fatal flaws, usually in goal. There's a fatal flaw named Tristan Jarry that is still technically on this team's books that they haven't been able to offload. think it's fair to ask whether or not a guy that in some corners of town is treated with deference, like he's going to do this, don't worry, don't sweat it, is actually capable of doing this. 412-928-9370. State of the Penguins address on State of the Team Day on the PM team. State of the PM team, by the way, my moles, my sources are telling me, good. Some would say very good. Some might say excellent. Some might say business is even booming. Just to throw that out.
AB could do a commercial for us.
He could. He could. Doing what's best for business on this show, Don. Best for business. PM team number two fan. Some would argue that he should be the number one fan. Pulled off a massive upset. Some thought in the PM team caller bracket. Jeff in South Park. We put out the siren call for Jeff. We got our vuvuzelas out. We started talking Penguins. We knew he would flock like the salmon of Capistrano to the phones. And he is
as much as I would.
Yes.
As much as I would like to chime in on the Steelers, like, yeah, I'm going to take this opportunity to talk about the Penguins, Smalley.
Jeff, hold on. First off, I do want you to start. I'm going to give you a wide berth here, but I do want your thesis statement about them. Mine was, how long will the bad times last? What is your thesis right now in Jeff in South Park, State of the Penguins? As avid a Penguins fan as we have that listens to this show.
Well, they're definitely going to be bad this year, and I could see it continuing for probably one more year after that. So maybe two seasons from now, we'll see some seeds start to grow a little bit. But, yeah, they're definitely going to be bad this year, and they'll probably be bad next year unless they get McKenna and he happens to be like Lemieux or Crosby and is just gangbusters right out of the gate. But one thing that you and I really truly disagree on, we've talked about it before, but, I mean, you brought it up again, so I'm going to bring it up again. I don't think you give hockey fans in this town enough credit insofar as when the team gets good again, it has to look a certain way. I just don't agree with that. Like, if you miss the playoffs for five consecutive seasons, which is basically what I'm throwing out there, and the team is littered with younger players and maybe Sid's still there, I don't think it matters what it looks like. I mean, I'll use the Cavs as an example. LeBron has left in two separate stints. Were Cavs fans clamoring for them to look a certain way when they got their next superstar? No, they did not. I was still living in Ohio at the time. Kyrie Irving was fully embraced. And now the current state of the Cavs, the same thing is happening. It doesn't have to look a certain way.
But so, wouldn't you argue, though, that they play when the Cavs were good and have been good this like past year before they kind of flamed out, crashed out in the playoffs, they played a very entertaining brand of basketball. I watched them. They would go up and down. They would be fun. I'm specifically talking about styles because, Jeff, you're, I think, roughly the same age as me. We've never really watched a Penguins team that said, you know what, we're going to be ultra-responsible in our own zone. Their most defensively sound teams were great at goal inhibition because they played with the puck so much. The old like Detroit Red Wings theory. If you don't give up the puck, you don't give the other team a chance.
You brought up the Constantine years, which was a great example, a great pull for you because you're absolutely right. And it's hilarious. If you look at Tom Barrasso's numbers from those years that Constantine was the coach, they're out of this world because they actually decide to play defense in front of him. I think other than those 2 years, you're right. However, I just think that like if the team was constructed in a totally different manner where like say they were built around an elite goaltender, you know, like let's say we got, you know, the next Roberto Luongo or whatever, and like that was the catalyst for building the team going forward. I think people would be all about that, man. I really do. And I don't think they'd care that we were winning games 2-1. Like, if you missed the playoffs for a certain number of years, like a minimum of five seasons, when that team gets good again, they're going to be hungry and the excitement's going to explode. I mean, it happened with the Pirates, you know, the Steelers, when they finally win a playoff game, it doesn't matter who the quarterback's going to be at that point. You're not going to sit there and nitpick and go, oh, well, you know, he's not Ben or whatever. You go through a drought, any sort of drought, you are going to embrace that team, especially if it's young, no matter what style they play, and you are going to be fully back. Of course, there are people like me who never leave. But
Jeff, that's that last point, though, unfortunately, I think kind of undercuts the rest of the message for me, and thank you for your call, as always. I think what you have right there is, Jeff, a true, and I think he would certainly proudly self-describe as an extremely avid Penguins fan, projecting how he would feel in this situation onto the casual fan, who is the fan that you have to get, you have to capture again if the team is bad for as many years in a row as it would be. You got to capture the casual person who wants to go and see 4-3, maybe 5-4. I don't know if New Jersey Devils 1995-style hockey, and I'm not saying exactly like that, that was truly brutal to watch. I'm not sure that that resonates with people the way it does when you have Crosby, Malkin, an offensive defenseman leading your core in Letang, like that through line back to Lemieux and Coffey and early Yager. I don't know how that looks if it's something that isn't what we've become accustomed to seeing. The numbers would be good. They'd probably sell out again. But if it was just a team of very good players that played very good system hockey that always wasn't like firecracker spectacular, I think there's cause to wonder how it would be perceived. I do. Or how it would be embraced is maybe the better word. It is time for a little PM Team Power Rankings live from the Rivers Casino Sportsbook. Before we dive in, a reminder, check out the latest episode of Breaking Bread. That's brought to you by Saloni's Italian Bread. Donnie sat down with Pat Freiermuth, who he can confidently and truly call a real friend. It's not just a business relationship. It's not just Donnie is a producer who's got a great Rolodex. These guys are actual buddies, one true football guy to another. That was really good stuff, the talk that they had. Go look at it and go watch it. Indulge yourself with a little football chat on the 93.7 The Fan YouTube page. Breaking Bread, brought to you by Saloni's Italian Bread. All right, Don. You're not a golf guy. I think, where's the last place you played? You played out at our buddy Vinny D's place, Manor Valley.
Manor Valley.
Yep. Had yourself a little scramble action.
Yeah, I had a couple good shots in there.
Did you make any putts longer than like 10 feet? Did you roll in another patented Donnie football
bomb? I did, believe
bomb?
It or not, the first hole we had. I think we started on 17 there.
Okay.
So kind of like going downhill, and then like you cross the little street right back into the rest of the course. Yeah.
It's Manor Valley's version of the road hole.
Yeah, I knocked down the first putt we had as a team for a birdie. For a birdie, Malzy.
Look at you. What'd you guys shoot?
Like 6 under.
That's
we
all
did
right.
not win.
No, you go to one of those, there's a good chance you'll get actually beaten by a team that shoots 17 under.
Yeah, I think the winning team was 14 under.
Even if nobody actually shoots that number, somebody usually pencil whips you, which is just continues to say that they had mulligans or whatever, and four guys wearing jorts shoot 22 under. Anyway, I digress. I love the Open Championship. I am not going to sit here and bicker with everybody about why it is my favorite tournament in all of golf, because I know where most people level out on that. And it's not where I do. I love early morning golf. I love the fact that it's so different from American courses. I love the fact that most of the places that you can play just happen to end up being open to the public over there. There's very few, like, true, you'll never get on it type of spots. Not that I'm saying that's a horrible thing. It's just a very different golfing culture over there. I still have never played over there. I am dying to just in the British Isles, whether it be Northern Ireland right now, even Ireland, Scotland, wherever. Got to get over there and play. I'm going to name, though, the 5 best major championship venues in golf. Donnie, I think you will have heard of 4 of these 5. In fact, I am positive you've heard of 4 of these 5. One, because I told you about one of them before the show today. The other 3, because you just literally would have no reason to have not heard of them. But I think number 5 might be the one you're not familiar with. 5th best major championship venue in golf today. We've got to go out to Strong Island, Shinnecock Hills, a place where they have lost the greens on certain holes at U.S. Opens, a place where Phil Mickelson once chased his ball down the hill and hit it back up while it was still moving. He was so angry. a place where Corey Pavin once hit one of the greatest shots you'll ever see to put a chokehold on a U.S. Open title way back in 1995, a four-wood, back when guys actually used four-woods, and they might have even been persimmon. It is a terrific golf course. It is a place, however, that gets dinged slightly on this list for one reason mainly. It is somewhat wind-dependent. If the wind is not blowing at a course that only hosts, and this is going to be important here, the course only hosts one of the four majors. It only hosts U.S. Opens anymore. You're not going to see anything else at Shinnecock. If the whole point of the U.S. Open is that it's course and USGA versus players, the fact that Shinnecock has to get a little gimmicky with its greens if there's no wind and guys can actually get after it a little bit, dings at a slight point. Only on this list, though. It's one of the best courses in the United States. It is one of the best courses in the world. I love watching it there. It just is not quite as good as the four that are ahead of it.
This may surprise you, Chris. Not only have I heard of it, I have a hat from Shinnecock.
Get the F out
yes,
of there.
I have a buddy who does work with Fox Sports, and
really?
one of the recent times that they hosted the U.S. Open, he got me a hat. I have a hat from there.
Color me stunned. I learn something new every day. This is like the Beethoven thing all over again. Number four, my power ranking. Five best major championship venues in golf. Shinnecock Hills, number five. Number four, some people, fake John and Robinson, thought that because I had just played this place, it would rock it up to number one on my list because of recency bias. Because of just I would be swept in by the majesty and the wonder of it. He was off by three spots. It's Pinehurst number two. It is one of three anchor sites for the U.S. Open. It is going to be hosting a ton of them in the next 20 years. It's going to be, I think, every 6 or 7 years, you're going to see a U.S. Open played at Pinehurst number two. I will echo some of the things people love Pinehurst number two say about it. It is absolutely playable for an average Joe Schmo, particularly if you are smart enough to pick the correct tee box, which I was not on my trip. Bit off more than I could chew and was a little bit beaten up by some of the distances. Not too badly, but it was a factor. It is also a course that does the rare thing. It's fun for somebody who is 20 handicap to play. It is insanely difficult for somebody who is one of the best golfers in the world to play. Here's something, Donnie. Old Don Ross was in his bag when he created Pinehurst number two. Big Donald Ross was in his bag. People forget Donald Ross knew how to challenge the best in the world.
Those courses go crazy, bro.
Those courses go absolutely crazy. It is pretty flat. There's some elevation change for a couple of holes, but it is kind of wild to think that a course that good can be on a parcel of land that is that flat, that has that little for the majority of its run, that little natural elevation change. The greens are diabolical. They got humps and bumps and swales. There's tons of short grass around them, so you get a lot of weird variety of shots. You have a lot of different options on how to play different shots, which is something that you know I love and most golf fans love. You can bump and run it. You can fly it in. You can putt it from everywhere. Martin Keimer won a U.S. Open by basically never taking a wedge around the green and just putting everything. It is a magnificent golf course. And you can also go and play it with your buddies. And I would suggest if you are an avid golf psycho, squirrel away money for maybe a year or two. Go out and make that part of your Pinehurst trip. You will not be disappointed. Number three, greatest major venues in golf in honor of the Open Championship. And hoo-hoo, baby, am I going to piss people off with this one. I've never been. I don't think I won the lottery to go this year for next year. It's the most famous golf course, arguably, in the world. Definitely the most famous in the United States. But it's only third on my list. Augusta National. Listen, great course. I've come to appreciate the course itself a lot more. I thought it was too easy. They still usually have guys go pretty low out there, 12, 13, 14 under. So it's harder than your average tour stop, but easier than some of the other courses on this list. It obviously has the Masters tradition. It obviously has all the ghosts. It has Amen Corner. It has very exciting holes at very exciting places on the course. 15 being number 15 and, like, not number 6, it's great. 12 being number 12, 13, like, all of it. The placement is great. It almost always produces really dramatic Sunday back nines. I really love it. I love watching it. I do. It just doesn't have the juice for me that the next two courses on the list have. It is in impeccable shape. I just feel sometimes that it can turn into a putting contest. There is a lot of strategy, but it can get a little too putting contest-y for me. Number 3, Augusta National. I can hear people already getting mad. Number 2 on the list, Don, and this might be a bigger shock than the last one, Oakmont Country Club. It's not number 1. I didn't go full homer on this. I didn't just say, well, you know, I did play it for media day. No. I am putting it at number 2 on the greatest major venues list. It is purpose-built. It might as well have been purpose-built. It wasn't, actually. You could say that about, like, TPC Sawgrass, built to hold a tour event, a big tour event. It might as well have been purpose-built to host the U.S. Open. It is the hardest golf course in the world, in my opinion. It is very fun to play. It will occasionally reward a pretty well-struck shot with a pretty bad result, but for the tournament that it hosts, as another anchor site for the U.S. Open, it's as good as it gets. I love the old bit Mike Davis, the old USGA director, used to say, if you needed to host the tournament tomorrow or in 2 weeks, you could go to Oakmont and do it. It's true. They're going to have the, I think the Oakmont Club Championship is this weekend. They're probably going to have the greens rolling at like a 17 out there now that the rough is cut back down. It is the best of the best in the United States for hosting a major, which should give you some clue as to number 1. The best major championship course in the world. It ain't Carnoustie, which probably jockeys with Oakmont as the toughest golf course on the planet. It's not Muirfield, which jockeys with several of the courses on this list as maybe just the best overall golf course on the planet. It's not where they're playing right now, Royal Portrush. It's not Royal Lytham and St. Anne's. It is, in fact, the home of golf, Don. The old course. Do guys go insanely low there? Yes. You could win at 20 under. You see it happen a lot. It is somewhat wind-dependent. They've got to have conditions to make it tough for these guys. The modern game, the modern tech has kind of outstripped it. But the charm, the way it still gets to guys, the road hole, the challenges you have to face and navigate, the way you have to handle links golf, the way things can turn on a dime based on the weather or just based on the pressure, just the way the last hole sets up, the Valley of Sin. Most guys can drive it now, but I think it just plays more difficult. It's got that Yankee Stadium vibe, but it happens to be in Scotland. It's the birthplace of the game. They've been playing golf there since the 15th century. I feel like I shouldn't have to defend this more, and so I'm not. The old course, pretty much always going to be number 1. I don't know how you're going to beat it. There it is, 5 best major venues in golf in honor of the Open Championship, which is at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland this year. Number 5, Shinnecock Hills. Number 4, Pinehurst. Number 2. Number 3, Augusta National. Number 2, Oakmont. And number 1, the old course at St. Andrews.